Offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and as always, I'm coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. At the very outset, very warm, hearty Navratri greetings to all of you, and even as we are basking in the joy of celebrating Navratri in Swami's presence, I hope all of you are able to tune in to our live broadcast. This year, we are also trying to broadcast the entire Yajna every morning, even as it starts at 7 in the morning, and that's what we did today. Hopefully, we'll be able to do that through the entire 7-day period. The Gita series, as you all know, is a program on which we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse, and it also gives us the opportunity to go into Swami's own work, the Gita Vahini, in detail, and learn from it even as we are going through the Bhagavad Gita, understand it. We are in that portion of the Bhagavad Gita, the fourth chapter, which is in many ways relevant to each one of us, because this is the chapter where Krishna speaks about his nature and the importance of understanding the nature of God. And given the opportunity that we all have of living in Swami's presence, I think this is very, very important for all of us to understand and apply our minds to. So in that sense, it's a important part. We covered two very important shlokas the last week. We covered shlokas 7 and 8 of the fourth chapter. They also happen to be a couple of the most popular shlokas from the Gita. Most people would have heard them. Arjuna had this doubt. Why should the infinite Lord come in a finite, perishable body, right? And that was a question that he voiced, not in the Gita, but Swami explains in the Gita Vahini. In reply to that, Krishna says that whenever there is a decline in dharma, dharmasya glanir bhavati, and when there is a rise in a dharma, abhyutthanam adharmasya, he says, I come in a human form. And in the next verse, which is verse number 8, he says, I come for the purpose of dharma samsthapana, the establishment of dharma, and I achieve that by protecting the good and punishing the evil. So these were the two verses. Much of what we discussed last week was about this concept of dharma itself, and what do we mean by when there is a decline in dharma. In essence, what we went through was every entity in creation, every object, every person, every entity is the right word, I can't think of anything better, has something which is referred to as sahaj guna, or the innate quality which defines that particular object or entity. For example, to burn whatever it comes in its way is the dharma of fire. To quench the thirst, we could say, is the dharma of water. But the word dharma is also used for those practices or activities that help in keeping these entities retain or express their dharma. And we spoke about with the example of water itself. Yes, water in its purest palatable form quenches thirst and is life-giving, but there is a certain process which is required to maintain water in such a form that it can perform its dharma. And it is like the purification of water which helps water retain that quality of being able to give life. Similarly, if we look at human life itself, Swami says human life is a gateway to divinity, and that is what is its innate nature or sahaja guna. And there are some activities that in a human lifetime we need to perform to ensure that the dharma of a human life can be expressed, that the human life gives us this opportunity of raising ourselves above animal life, above a human life, to a divine status, right? So that is also referred to as dharma. And when Krishna says dharma se glanir bhavati, it is the decline in the practice of dharma, because the innate quality or sahaja guna, that will not change. ages might come and go. Dharma is God ordained, and that does not change. That does not have a decline or a rise. It is stable. It is constant. It is only the practice which changes, and God comes down in a human form to rejuvenate this practice of dharma. And when God comes in a human form, he does it by infusing faith in those who are good so that they may carry on doing their dharma, right? One of the beautiful definitions for the word sadhu, which Swami gives in the Gita Vaini, because Krishna says, paritranaya sadhunam. Swami says, the word sadhu is referred to anyone who is trying to uphold dharma. The word sadhu also refers to those who are trying to perform their duty in spite of the innumerable number of obstacles that come in their way. So God comes in a human form to enthuse those people who wish to follow the good but probably lack the courage, probably lack the conviction. And as we, towards the end, we saw that is why Swami says the greatest blessing that God gives, or when Swami gives, we refer to it as the Abhaya Hasta, which means the conferring of fearlessness, because that is the most essential quality required for a person to stick to dharma. So these were the two verses we completed last week, 7 and 8, and as we just went through more than the verses, it was this concept of dharma, which has different meanings, and the idea of what does Krishna mean when he say sadhu and dushkrita. We'll go to the next verses. These are all connected to what Krishna spoke just now, but we will see how they are connected and how it is very important for us, as I said in the right in the beginning, to pay attention to what Krishna is saying in these few verses. We'll listen to verse number 9 in the voice of Brother Shyam, as we always do. At the end of it, I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and we will speak about it in detail after that.
जन्म कर्म च मे दिव्यम् एवं यो वेत्ति तत्त्वतः त्यक्त्वा देहं पुनर्जन्म नैति मामेति सोऽर्जुन.
He who thus knows truly the divine birth and actions of mine does not get another birth after casting off the body. He attains me, O Arjuna. So this is the 9th verse in chapter 4. Krishna just clearly explained the nature of his entire incarnation, right? And if we have to summarize in one word some of the most important points that Krishna had said, especially the verses which came before the two verses that we just discussed, if there is one word which can define what Krishna is and Krishna's nature is, that word I would choose is free. Because his nature or his birth is not bound by any karma by the from the past, like you and me. It is not bound by any desire or any need, and it is not bound to any certain prakriti or nature. It is absolutely free from any form of selfishness or self-interest. And Krishna also explained the preconditions that caused the avatar to take birth. If we consider what Krishna said, you know, he said, paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha dushkritam, that for rewarding the good and punishing the bad, God incarnates. The question comes, why should God incarnate for that? Won't good be rewarded and bad be punished even otherwise? In fact, we have been speaking about that all through the second and third chapter, that the consequence of karma is inescapable. You can escape from the law, you can hoodwink every person you come across in life, but karma will always catch up, right? That's something that we had discussed. Similarly, it might appear that no one is recognizing our goodness or whatever we are doing is going unrewarded and unrecognized, but karma is such that you will definitely get the benefit of whatever you do, good or bad, eventually. So you don't necessarily need God to come in a human form to make the system work, because the good will be rewarded and the bad will be punished. And that is the nature of system itself as God is created. As I mentioned last week, we need to be reminded and sensitized about the system. And that is one of the roles that the Lord plays when he comes in a human form. Those who are good but begin to start slipping into evil out of probably frustration need to be bolstered. Their confidence needs to be bolstered, right? But more importantly, the good have to be made aware of something that is higher than the rewards which are available within the world, right? From seeking rewards only in the worldly plane, those who are good, especially those who have been dharmic, have to be given an inkling or given this hint about something which is more than what can be won, and which is in fact the dharma of human life itself. But if we truly look at whatever Krishna has been saying, you know, there is no one, two or three reasons which can completely or comprehensively give you the reasons for an avatar's descent, right? Though Krishna did give it in two verses, and those two verses we spent an entire episode talking about, what Krishna was explaining to Arjuna here can be considered somewhat contextual. If you really look at it, the entire discussion which is happening, Krishna is trying to emphasize the importance of performing one's dharma and how it must be performed, right? That's the thing that we've been going through all this while. In that context, Krishna said, see, I don't have any desires or duties, but I still act. Then he goes on to say, even I come to protect and foster dharma, right? He says that when there's a decline in dharma, I manifest myself. So he's trying to make Arjuna understand, look at all of these. Don't you think you should also be prepared to sacrifice anything and everything to foster dharma when I myself am giving it so much importance? And when the avatar comes, one thing which clearly happens, as I said, this the system is inescapable, is infallible. Good will be rewarded with good, bad will be punished eventually. And this is not a system where someone has to remember or someone should have witnessed what you've done. It's a perfect system of recording, as Swami would often say, that not one of your acts goes unrecorded, right? But when an avatar comes, the divide between the good and the bad gets widened. That's one of the things which happens. When God comes in a human form, the opportunity to raise oneself becomes immense. So many, many times Swami would say this, that, you know, even the smallest of good action that you do in Swami's presence or as an offering to Swami will be rewarded 100 times more than what it would have been usually rewarded. There is that beautiful episode from the childhood of Lord Krishna where there is this lady who comes selling fruits, right? And she always, those were the days of the barter system, she would sell fruits and she would take a measure of rice or grains or lentils in return. And she comes around and she finds this little child who's a 3-year-old baby who's walking around, 3 or 4-year-old little child. And Krishna looks at this lady who's selling fruits and says, will you offer me some of those fruits? And the lady says, what will you give me in return? So Krishna says, so why should I give you something in return? You have some fruits, I want it, and so I'm asking you. So Krishna pretends as though he's a little child, too innocent to know the ways of the world, that there is something called buying and selling. So this lady begins to explain to Lord Krishna that, you know, you should give me something and I will give you this in return, and that's how business transactions happen. So the little lord says, all right, I will get you some grain from my house. So he goes into the granary in the house and brings a fistful of rice. But when he comes, even as he's walking, he spills most of it, and finally when he reaches the lady, he hardly has a few grains. But this lady is so, you know, charmed by this little child, and she doesn't want to disappoint him. So she gives the fruits which Krishna wants, and she takes those few grains that the Lord gives. This is a small episode, a small incident where any good-natured lady probably must have done this with a small child. But the child is not any ordinary child. The child is the avatar, the Lord himself. So when she later goes back, she finds those few grains that she received from Krishna have all become precious gems and gold coins, right? This is not an episode which is simply fascinating to narrate. It is a very telling episode. Even the smallest good, which is otherwise rewarded with X amount of good karma, or however you would like to measure that, gets 100 times more benefit when this same transaction happens in the presence of the Lord. And Swami would quite similarly warn us that the wrong that is done in Swami's organization, in Swami's presence, in spite of you having Swami in your life, the punishment for that becomes immense, because the opportunity is immense, the fall also becomes immense in that sense. So though Krishna explains an avatar in just two verses, it is not that this concept can be easily grasped. The two explanations, the two definitions of an avatar's descent which Krishna gives is pretty much contextual, and that's why I said this in the beginning of last week's episode. This is not complete because there is no mention of bhakti, which is a very, very important concept which Swami speaks extensively in the Bhagavata Vahini. Swami says the dharma samsthapana and the fostering of the good and punishment and all that is there, but the primary reason the Lord manifests is because there have been people who are pure at heart, who have been craving for him, and it is to satisfy them he comes, and dharma samsthapana and all of that happens once the Lord comes, right? So it is very difficult to define the descent or the nature of an avatar in a couple of verses. And that is why in this particular verse that we just heard, Krishna says that understanding the nature of the avatar blesses one with the ultimate reward itself. He says, Yevam, thus, yo veti tattvataha. He who understands the essence, tattvataha is, understands me in my real sense, in my real essence. Veti means has the knowledge, and tattvataha is to know God in his essence. Janma karma chame divyam. Of my janma or birth, karma or actions, which are divyam or divine. Janma karma chame divyam. Yo veti tattvataha janma karma chame divyam. Whoever understands me in essence, whoever understands my birth and my actions. Tyaktva deham. When the body is given up, na eti, does not have punarjanma, another birth. Mameti so Arjuna, such a person, O Arjuna, attains me. So certainly the knowing of the nature of the avatar and the process to know him is certainly not simple. It will give the ultimate. So knowing the nature of the avatar is equivalent to the entire process itself, isn't it? When we say the goal of human life and the goal of human endeavor is to attain the Lord, and when Krishna is saying that if you understand me, you attain me, which means to understand him is the definition of the entire process itself. The whole journey is equivalent to this effort of understanding the nature of an avatar. But we are not to say, oh, is that so complex? Then forget it. Let's not try even trying to understand the Lord. Let us not even make an attempt. Because I thought it could be understood by two verses, verses 7 and 8 of the fourth chapter. But now you're saying that it's too complex. So let us not make the effort. But we are not to discard it in that manner. And Swami says in the Gita Vahini, and I quote two very, very beautiful and profound lines. Swami says, all cannot recognize them, the avatars, as divine. Yet, no one should avoid contact with the Lord come in human form. Try your best and utilize every chance. There should be no lapse on your part. End of quote. So Swami says that you have to try. You should not give it up. And as much as you try, that much reward there is. Those who understand tattvataha, essence in its entirety, yes, they reach the Lord. But those who understand even a fraction will benefit so much, right? So Swami says that when you know that the Lord is here in a human form, you should not leave any stone unturned. You have to make every effort possible to go close to the Lord, to spend as much time with the Lord, to contribute to whatever, in whatever way, or to act in whatever way by which you move closer to the Lord, right? So that is what Swami says. In the next verse, Krishna says that many have attained this. It is not that this is unattainable or this is impossible. It is difficult, but it is not impossible. So don't think of it as being unattainable and give up even before you start. But then he also explains what are the qualifications required if one has to really, truly understand the nature of the Lord when he comes down in a human form. So we'll go to verse number 10. It's a continuation of whatever Krishna has been saying. We'll listen to that. I'll give you a brief meaning and then we'll discuss in detail.
Vitaraga bhaya krodha manmaya mamupashritah bahavo jnana tapasa puta madbhava magatah.
Many who were devoid of attachment, fear and anger, who were absorbed in me, who had taken refuge in me, and were purified by the austerity of knowledge, have attained my state. Once again, whenever the Gita speaks about understanding, or Vedanta in general speaks of understanding, it is very, very different from merely knowing something theoretically or being having the knowledge of something, or in the sense of the general knowledge that we have, or the bookish knowledge that we have, as Swami would say it. When Vedanta says knowing something, the way Vedanta defines that knowing is completely different. We've spoken about that, I'll not repeat it again. So if you know God and His ways, if you truly understand the ways of an avatar, the state of our mind will be completely different. It cannot know and be the same. The one who truly acknowledges God in their life cannot lead their life the same way before and after the entry of God. I think this is something which each one of us as Swami's devotees should always remember. If I have led my life in a certain manner and Swami has entered my life should have changed. And there is no better way of capturing the presence of the Lord in your life than in the manner of some form of transformation of our habits, of our life, of our lifestyle. So there is no better way of capturing the presence of the Lord in our life than change. So when you know God in His true sense, the mind's nature, the mind state will be completely overhauled. A few weeks back, I happened to be speaking to a very elderly person and she started speaking about Lord Krishna. I think it was around the time of Krishna Janmashtami. To give you a background about this person, she's a very devoted person otherwise, and she comes from a very traditional Indian family, a devotee of Swami for decades. But I was pretty surprised by the way she was speaking about Lord Krishna. And, you know, she was saying, about the Kurukshetra war and how destructive it was. It is said that the Kurukshetra war was probably 10 or 100 times more destructive than the world wars that we have seen, or even the nuclear bomb which was dropped. And I mean, there are some descriptions about the casualty which the Kurukshetra war caused. So she was referring to all of that and say, you know, all of this happened only because of Krishna. You know, poor Arjuna wanted to go away, but he made him stand there and fight and see all this destruction he only caused. And then she went on saying about how Krishna manipulated during the war and how he plotted against some noble soul like Karna and got him killed. And all of this, and she was saying that, you know, all of this was caused by Krishna, and, you know, Krishna is not I don't like the character of Krishna, and he was very cunning. She went on quoting all of these incidents and examples and giving a very, very dismal character sketch of Krishna. The interesting thing is, nothing what she said was factually incorrect. In the sense that, yes, Krishna did stop Arjuna, right? And that's how we started the Gita series. And Krishna was indeed involved in the killing of Karna in a seemingly unfair manner. But every act of God will be completely different if we see it through the point of view of the intention with which it was done. from the description that Krishna gave of himself, he said, I have nothing to gain. And then he said, Prakritim Swam Adhishtayas Sambhavami. I am not under the control of Prakriti, or I am not dictated by Prakriti or nature. I am in control of Prakriti and I make an advent. What is the essence of this statement? This is a very, very profound statement where he says, Prakritim Swam Adhishtaya Sambhavami. I am in full control of Prakriti and I am born. When we refer to what we refer to as Prakriti, Swami would say is made of the three gunas, Sattva, Rajas and Tamas. And when one is under the influence of the three gunas, only then the person will be subject to selfishness, wrongdoings, fear, desires and anger and lobha and all of that. The Lord comes as someone who stands completely above these feelings. He pretends to be angry, he pretends to like someone or something, but one should never mistake this to be the nature of the Lord. He is completely above any of these human feelings. When we misunderstand in this manner, it is in many ways a sign that we have these flaws in us and we are trying to project it on God. Don't take me wrong, I'm not saying this to put down the elderly devotee I was speaking to. I'm saying this so we can, in a certain way, analyze ourselves. Let me try to explain that. Now, our goal is to go beyond raga bhaya krodha, as was mentioned in this particular shloka, which is attachment, fear and anger. And if you recall, this same phrase that Krishna is using here, Vita Raga Bhaya Krodha, freed from attachment, fear and anger, he had used it to describe the nature of a Stita Prajna way back in the second chapter. So our goal is to reach a state where we have no attachments, and since we have no attachments, when we reach that state, we will have no fear and no frustrations whatsoever. But right now, we have these flaws and they keep disturbing our mind, right? Krishna had said that when he described the Stita Prajna, he said, Vita Raga Bhaya Krodha Stita Dhir Munirruchya. He says, Vita Raga Bhaya Krodha Stita Dhir Munirruchya. He is one who has given up these three, Raga Bhaya Krodha, and thus has a stable mind, a still and calm mind, and such a person is called a muni or a sage. So when there is no attachment, there will be no fear or frustration and the mind will be calm and steady to see things as they are. But we think that our mind is not calm because of the people we interact with. Why do I lose my temper? Because somebody in front of me is irritating me. Why am I upset, or why am I not being peaceful? Because a colleague is not good to me, or someone is manipulating me, or someone is doing all of this. I'm not saying that it is not true. The trigger points for all the disturbances that we experience in our mind may be outside, but the source of the problem is within us, and that is true always. The flaws are there outside also. That cannot be denied. Yes, there are irritating people outside, wrong happenings around us all the time. But as long as we are looking only outward, we will never look within and fix our problem. Let me give you an analogy, an example, and let's see if that explains it better for us. It is like looking at a mirror. Let us say that every mirror that I come across has some problem or the other. You know, it's a distorted mirror. Some show me fat, some show me dark, some show me having some flaws in my skin because the mirror itself is having some kind of problems. As Swami would say, if the mirror is not coated properly, then you know the mirror will not show you the right image. But there is a possibility, like say my hair is disheveled or my clothes are crumpled or I have some kind of a stain on my face. It is true that the mirror is flawed, but in pointing to the flaws of the mirror, even though I stand in front of it with, say, some flaws in myself, I might dismiss the flaws that I see in this mirror as the flaws of the mirror and not my own, right? That's a possibility which is always there. If it's a distorted mirror and I stand in front of it, and let's say my shirt is crumpled, I look at the reflection in the mirror and I might say that, no, the shirt is appearing crumpled because the mirror is itself having some issue with it, right? There is this very beautiful, before I come to that. So this is the problem we have when we point out to others and say that, you know, I'm unhappy or I'm angry or I'm disturbed because of all of these people. Let us say that one day you come across a mirror that is perfect in all ways. There are no flaws in the mirror. Isn't that a good chance for us to look at and say that now I know what are the flaws in me, right? Now when I know that this mirror is perfect and I stand in front of it, whatever flaws I see in the reflection now, I can be completely sure that these are flaws in me. When I see a stain there, I know that it's a stain on my clothes or it's a stain on my face. I know it's not in the mirror, a flaw in the mirror, right? Something very similar happens in our interaction with Swami or when we know about or read about an avatar. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, there is this very beautiful interaction when Sukha Maharishi, we all know the context, Sukha Maharishi, the great Rishi, is narrating the story of Lord Krishna and the Bhagavatam entirely, of many, many avatars of the Lord, to King Parikshit. So he comes to this point where he starts describing the leelas of Lord Krishna with the Gopikas, especially the description of the Rasa Leela and Krishna stealing their clothes and all of that. And Parikshit is pretty confused at this narration. He's having a look of doubt on his face, and the sage looks at him and says, "What is it, Parikshit? What is troubling you?" And then Parikshit says, "But Master, all this is fine, but isn't this adharma? Isn't this an inappropriate behavior from a man?" Right? Of course, it is the Lord, but isn't all of these inappropriate behavior? How can Krishna behave like these with women? And in reply to that, Sukha Maharishi tells him, among the other things, there's a long explanation that he gives. Many, many beautiful and very important and relevant points are there. But one thing which Sukha Maharishi emphasizes and says is, O King, never for a moment forget whose stories you're hearing. Whatever be the incident, however it might disturb your idea of what is right and wrong, never for a moment forget whose stories these are. However inappropriate it may appear, never forget that these are stories of the Supreme Lord, who is by nature gunatita, who is beyond the gunas, who is beyond prakriti, right? So even when we started the Bhagavad Gita, we had, you know, I'd refer to a very, very profound and beautiful statement that Swami makes in the Gita Vaini, where Swami says, first and foremost, we need an attitude of reverence for taking up the study of the Gita. And that reverence comes from the belief that these are words of the Supreme Lord Himself. So this information of the avatar has been given to us. The nature of the avatar is given to us as information that he is selfless, he is beyond greed, lust, anger, and any such pettiness. Going back to the mirror analogy, we have been given this information that this mirror is perfect. And when we come face to face with a perfect mirror, it gives us this opportunity for us to look at the reflection and look at ourselves. And when we go through life, even if we assume, you know, Swami would say that there is Srishti lo lopam emi ledu, anni lopam drishti lo ne undi, right? This is something which Swami would say. There is no flaw in the creation. All flaw is in the perception. So even if we assume that, I come across very many different people in life, in my workplace, in my neighborhood, in my journeys. But I always tell myself, no, the world is perfect. Whatever flaw is there, it is only within me. Even then, it gives me an opportunity to always look within and correct myself. But this opportunity to come face to face with an avatar, to come and interact with an avatar, gives us an opportunity to be convinced. We've been given the information that this is a perfect mirror. Whatever this mirror says, it does not have flaws in itself, right? So for coming face to face with Swami is an opportunity where we look at it and say that whatever I'm seeing, it is an opportunity to recognize a flaw which is there within me. And Swami would often tell us this: if I don't speak to you, if I show anger to you, you must understand that I am pointing to a flaw in you, because I don't have these traits. I don't have anger. I don't have favoritism. I do not look at somebody and say, this person is rich, so let me talk to him. This person is more handsome and beautiful, so let me talk to him. Swami said, I do not have any such preferences. So when I show any emotion, you must understand that there is some flaw in me I am calling your attention to, and you must try to work on it, right? Anyway, in this, we will slowly, when interacting with an avatar, we gain this opportunity to get rid of what we refer to as raga, bhaya, krodha, right? And as we get rid of these flaws, we will begin to understand Swami's nature better. That is why Krishna first said, whoever knows the nature of my descent will reach me. But then he explains how such people will be, or what will be the nature of such people who understand his nature. He says, Vita raga bhaya krodha, devoid of attachments, fear and anger, manmaya, absorbed in me, mam upashrataha, they will be taking refuge in me always. So in this shloka, Krishna gives a hint as to what will be the nature of a person who truly knows him, who truly knows his tattva. In fact, much later in the last chapter, in the 18th chapter, Krishna is going to, there's another beautiful verse which connects to this verse. Here Krishna says, those who understand my tattva will reach me. In the 18th chapter, Krishna will tell who can understand the Lord's tattva. Right, we'll come to that when we come to that. But here he clearly says there is no distinction between knowing God and knowing the self. We have this understanding that one who keeps inquiring about the self is a jnani, and one who and such a person is on the jnana marga, and one who keeps thinking of God and his leelas and lost in the sankirtana, he is a devotee, a bhakta who is in the path of bhakti. But Krishna clearly says, manmaya mam upashrataha, one who is immersed in thoughts of me, one who takes refuge in me, which is a clear description of a devotee. And then he goes on to say, jnana tapasa putaha, those who are purified by the penance of jnana. So this particular verse, it can either be seen as both kinds of people, those that are devoted and try to be immersed in God, or those who take the path of inquiry, both of them reach me. That is one way of looking at it. But they have to be, the qualification is, they have to be purified. Putaha. That is non-negotiable. And he says, bahavaha, many such individuals, madbhavam, my being, agataha, have attained. So this way of looking at it is, in a way, more appropriate, as we will see, that is emphasized in the next shloka also, that saying that, you know, whichever path you take, you will finally reach me, as long as it purifies you. But it can also mean that a true bhakta is also a jnani. A jnani cannot but become a bhakta. And something, this is something that Swami says repeatedly in Swami's work, the Jnana Vahini. But the unifying factor is the purification that will occur. Be it bhakti, jnana or karma, or if there are combinations of this or any other path, if it does not purify the individual, if it does not purify the mind, all of it is pointless. If it does not remove raga and dvesha, if it does not remove bhaya, krodha, lobha, greed, anger, jealousy and all of that, then the path has not completely worked on us. So one way of looking at the shloka is to say that many people have reached me, O Arjuna, some who have immersed themselves in me and taken refuge in me and thereby have removed attachment, fear and anger. or some who have purified themselves through the fire of jnana, all of these people have reached me. Or it can be explained as, those that are immersed in me, who take refuge in me, are freed from attachment, fear and anger, and such a person attains true jnana, thereby perfect purity, and bhavaha, many such, madbhavam agataha, have attained me. So I think both explanations are valid, but the important point is, knowing God makes one reach God. Brahmavid brahmaiva bhavati. But one cannot know God without being purified. Maybe I'll end the explanation for this particular shloka with what Swami himself says in commentary of these shlokas. Swami explains the 10th verse in this manner, and I quote, this is what Swami says, Arjuna, not all can understand the divine nature of my birth and action. Only those who are free from attachment, hatred, fear and anger, who are immersed in the name and the form of the Lord, who know of no other support than me, who are sanctified by the knowledge of the Atma, only those can grasp it. Those who seek me undeviatingly, who possess truth, dharma and love, will reach me. This is absolutely true. Take it from me. Give up any doubt you may have. People render the inner consciousness impure by dwelling on the objective world through ignorance. They take delight in mere sound, taste, form, etc. When they seek objective pleasures, they are tempted to secure the objects that give the pleasure. Foiled in the attempt, they get restless, hateful, and afraid. Fear robs people of their mental resources. It creates anger that cannot be easily pacified. Thus, desire, anger, and fear are aroused one after the other, and these have to be removed. Arjuna, resolve these facts in your mind and then act. Become reasonable. Have faith in my words. End of quote. The next few shlokas are an explanation of an unasked question, so to say. I mean the doubt that Arjuna had but did not express in the Bhagavad Gita. So there is no shloka in the Gita which says that Arjuna uvacha and then the doubt. But Krishna went on to clarify it nevertheless in the next few verses. So we are fortunate that in the Gita Vahini, Swami writes the unexpressed question of Arjuna so we can understand the flow itself. Again, let me go back to the Gita Vahini and quote what Swami says. I quote, Arjuna heard all this and asked, O Nandakumara, why can't you make this sacred and high stage available for all people? You have announced yourself as the embodiment of love and full of compassion. Why then all this partiality? I must declare it as favoritism, for you endow this stage only on the wise and deny it to the ignorant. I would even say that the ignorant person who has no discrimination, the person who swings like the pendulum of the clock from one thing to another, merits your grace more. The wise person knows everything and is aware that the world is pervaded by God. The world is Vishnu Maya. Why then should it be clear, made clearer to him who already knows? Such a person has no more need for grace. End of quote. So Arjuna is asking, but why this partiality? When you have, let's say, two children at home, one is intelligent and gets first rank in school, the other is distracted and is probably not as good as the other sibling. The mother will not feed one and not feed the other, right? Or the mother will not spend more time with the one who is already intelligent and ignore the one who is not doing well in studies. In fact, the one who is weak and one who is not able to focus and study needs more attention from the mother, right? So Arjuna is asking, why this partiality? If mukti is the ultimate, and if those who don't have it suffer endlessly, why don't you, Krishna, who is all compassionate, give mukti to everyone? But there's a slight mistake in the way Arjuna is thinking, and Krishna is going to explain that in the next verse. But this is a very, very important question that he's asking. Why can't mukti be given to everyone, right? the answer that Krishna gives again is a very, very important one, which he says in the next verse. So we listen to the next verse, the 11th verse of the 4th chapter. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and we'll discuss that before we conclude for today.
Ye yathamam prapadyante tanstathaiva bhajamyaham mama vartmanu vartante manushyah partha sarvashah.
According to the manner in which they approach me, I favor them in that very manner. O son of Partha, human beings follow my path in every way. Going back to the analogy of the mother and children, yes, the mother loves the children equally, and let's say she cooks a very tasty pizza for the 10-year-old son. However much she loves all the children equally, she cannot feed the same, pizza for, let's say, if she has a 6-month-old child. The level of maturity, the level of acceptance does matter, right? The love is the same, the Lord is equal in that manner, but each one has a different capacity. And that also is a part of the Lord's love, where he gives each one according to their own needs and their own capacity, isn't it? So Krishna says, look, whatever people seek, that is what I give. If you ask for something, why will I give something else? But this shloka can be looked at in a couple of ways. One is, as I said from the previous verse, some might approach through devotion, some may approach through jnana. So Krishna says, ye, whoever, yatha, in whichever way, mam prapadyante, approach me, tan, to them, yatha eva, in the same manner, bhajamyaham, I reward them. So Krishna clearly states, you cannot blame me for being partial. I am only giving people what they seek, what they want. In the modern world that we all live in, most of us don't want others to choose for us, right? That's the nature of all of us. That's the nature of especially the younger generation, right? Why is it that we all hold the idea of democracy so high and we don't like the idea of dictatorship or monarchy? I should have the freedom to choose what I want. Others should not decide what I eat. Others should not decide what I wear or how I pray and how I lead my life. We always want the power for self-determination, right? It is because we think that we know what is best for us. And this is precisely the expression of ego and ignorance, which is something which is going to last till the last lap of the journey. The whole idea is to remove this ego, and with this ego, the ignorance also will go. But till that point, we all believe that we know what is best for us, right? And that's why in the path of bhakti, that is the attitude which is made as an offering. The final Atmanivedanam is that when you look at the Lord and say, I give up my choice-making abilities. I know that what you choose for me is best, and so I accept it, right? That's what we refer to as surrender. But till then, we all believe that we know what is right. In every prayer that we make to Swami, we think that we know what is best for us. Even in the noble prayers that we make, even if there's a young student who's saying, Swami, please, I want to become a student of Swami, I want to become a student in your college, or someone who's saying that, Swami, I want to come and settle in Prashanti Nilayam and be close to you. All of these are expressions of this idea that I know what is best for me. An expression of this ignorance that I know what is the right thing for me. It is not always wrong, but it is an expression of whatever we have come to understand till that point in life, right? So Krishna says, I have laid out everything in front of you. It's all before you, the worldly and the spiritual. Now, all choices are left to you. But all choices come with a certain baggage. And even that is explained to you, right? For example, if I'm tempted to procure an object which does not belong to me and I say, let me steal it or let me take it without anybody's knowledge. Yes, by doing that act, I will have the object. I want the object, I have the object. But when I procure it through the process of stealing, there are some consequences which come with that and I will have to accept it, right? Or say I don't steal it. Let's say that I procure it in the dharmic manner. I work hard, I earn my money, and with that dharmic earning of mine, I procure this particular object. But this act also comes with a certain understanding. And Swami would say, you are trying to find happiness in that object that you're procuring and saying that this is mine and I want this, or if I have this, I will be happy. In other words, you're saying you're investing your happiness in an object. And Swami would say that every object, every achievement, everything in this world is actually finite. And everything that is finite can give only a finite amount of joy. That is the nature of everything in the world, and we all know it. So when we desire it, we are literally booking a date with our disappointment. We're just saying that at some point, this object is going to stop giving me happiness, and then I will be disappointed, right? So we do this mistake over and over again. We still ask God for this, and God says, okay, if you want this, that is what you will have, and that's what Krishna explains in this verse. And of course, this is not straightforward. I'm sure even as I'm saying the statement, many people might be saying that, oh, but I ask Swami for so many things and Swami never answers my prayers. Yes, down the line, what happens is there are consequences for everything that we have sought, everything that we have gone after. And all of that starts working up, right? Somebody who is locked up in the prison would be praying for freedom, right? And he might say that I am praying for freedom and Swami is not giving that. But then you made a choice sometime back and this is a reward for that. This is the consequence for that. So this also have to be played out. So that is why it becomes absolutely complex. It is not that when Krishna says, whatever you ask, I give you, we as devotees cannot say, but I asked and I did not get. We did not get because it's so complex in that manner, right? So Swami says, I give you all that you ask for till one day you are prepared to ask for what I have come to give. What is it that God comes to give? God comes to give something that the world cannot give. As we just saw, Swami would say, how can you get nitya sukham or eternal happiness from this anitya loka, or this ephemeral world? What is finite can never give joy that is infinite. Only the Lord who is nitya, who is eternal, can grant us happiness which is nitya. So at some point in this journey, we will turn to God and ask for something which can be got only from God. Right now, if you look at all our prayers, we are asking from Swami things that we can procure with our own human effort. We want a seat for our child, we want a promotion in our work, or we want a seat in a college. Much of this can be procured by human effort or by asking people around us. But there is something which the Lord alone can give, and at some point we will stop and turn to God and ask for that which the world cannot give, only God can give. And till that point, Krishna says that whatever you ask for, I am here to give. And even in bhakti, if you look at it from the point of view of different pathways, there's someone who's probably crying to Lord Krishna, someone who's crying for a vision of Lord Jesus, or somebody might be crying for an experience of some other form. The Lord answers all these prayers in the manner they seek. The vision is given of the form that you worship, right? That's something that Swami would often say. That is why in the next line in this particular shloka, Krishna says, Partha, O Arjuna, Manushyaha Sarvashaha. People in all ways, Mama Vartma, my path anuvartante, is what they follow. Meaning, however different the paths may appear, they are all eventually my paths. In other words, paths that lead to me. Who reaches me? Those that have conquered Raga Bhaya Krodha and who have become purified by the fire of Jnana. In the previous verse, Krishna uses the word Bahavaha, which means many, many have reached me. Probably Arjuna could have got this doubt. Why many and why not all? So Krishna says, yes, all can reach me, but this is the condition that somebody has to have given up raga, bhaya, krodha, and they should have become purified. This condition is fulfilled only by a few, and whoever fulfills these conditions, they reach me, and there are many who have reached me like that. Right? So that is what Krishna says in this particular verse. That is why this is a very beautiful verse where Krishna explains it has many, many ways of looking at it. Those who approach Lord by the path of bhakti will seek him in that same path. Those who approach the Lord through the path of karma or through the path of jnana attain the Lord through that path. So Krishna says, all these are many paths, all of them lead to me. The other way of looking at it, as we said, is what you seek is what you get, right? Till the point that we are mature enough to ask for the ultimate. Swami says, I will wait, right? I am ready to wait. And when you are asking for the right thing, I will give you. I think the best way to conclude this episode probably is to again go back to Swami's Gita Vahini, and we'll end with what Swami says. It is not merely what Krishna is telling to Arjuna, though Swami has put it in those words. This is what Swami is telling each one of us devotees, and probably it's a good thing to end with that passage. Swami says, I am like a wish-fulfilling tree. My task is to give each what they ask for. I have no prejudice, no favoritism. Not even the shadow of cruelty can touch me. No fault can be imputed to me. The rays of the sun fall equally upon all that are directly in their way. But if something is behind something else, inside a closed room, for instance, how can the sun illumine? Cultivate the higher yearnings and you receive the higher gains. The fault lies in the aspirant and their aspirations, not in the Lord's attitude. End of quote. So as I said, this is not merely what Lord Krishna is telling Arjuna, but this is what Swami is telling all of us. Don't attribute flaws to me. Don't look at me and say, oh, Swami was so kind to Swami's students. They were very special for Swami. Or Swami gave so much more attention to the rich devotees. These are all flaws that we attribute to Swami. Swami had no distinctions. What you sought from him is what you got, right? And the reason why Swami says that is not because Swami is cruel again. He said, it's not like Swami is giving you something lesser and saying that, oh, you asked for it, so I'm giving it to you. It is not even in that manner. Because whatever be the path, even if you come to God and asking and praying for petty things, but if we undergo this process of purification, if we allow our devotion to Swami purify our mind and eventually turn the mind slowly towards the path of jnana, as Swami said, if the fire, the tapas of jnana can purify the mind, you will reach there. You could have started off as an artha arthaarthi. You could have started off as somebody who came to Swami purely to become rich or purely to have an upturn of your fortunes. But if you've been a true seeker, if you've been a true devotee, if you've truly loved Swami, it will eventually lead to the Lord, right? So it is not a verse where Krishna says, you asked for it, so I gave it to you. It is Krishna saying, you ask for whatever you want, but ensure that this happens. That path itself will lead to me. You do not have to stop, come around, and find a different pathway and reach me. The same way you are walking, if you seek me, you will eventually get me. So it's a verse of promise. It's a verse of benediction. So with that, dear listeners, I most humbly offer this episode at Swami's Lotus Feet. I thank you all for joining me week after week. Once again, a very, very hearty Navratri greetings to all of you. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the last segment of today, the Vahini Satsang. I'll join you all again next week in the continuation of the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Till then, take care. Jai Sai Ram.